From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll learn about new data that sheds light on the employment situation for the fastest growing demographic group in the Milwaukee area.
Then we learn about the surprisingly creative work learned by merchandise management students.
They not only learn the business of fashion and the planning and all of that, but it also, they can become stylists. They're taking the product that's already been designed and putting it together in a way that works for either the retailer or for the customers themselves.
And the local band Mile Friend pays tribute to Milwaukee's own Al Jarreau.
When I started, it was just like I said, I wanted to do tribute to Al and just play his music, you know. Talk about like the Olympic basketball team, you want your dream team. I got my dream team. I found the people that I absolutely wanted to do this with.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. As we learned in our Lake Effect on-site broadcast not too long ago, Milwaukee's Latino or Hispanic community has grown to represent an increasingly important segment of the Milwaukee area's population at large.
But while we know that, there are a lot of gaps in our knowledge of how some of the region's newest residents are faring in the overall economy. There are questions that the organization called Hispanic Professionals of Greater Milwaukee wanted to explore.
They turned to the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which this morning releases a report called Upward Mobility that looks expressly at earning power and education levels among Hispanic people here. Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher at the forum, and he joins us in the studio to share what they learned. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with a statistic that I was actually unaware of, at least to this degree. The Hispanic population in Metro Milwaukee has accounted for all of the region's net population growth since the beginning of the century. Is that right?
Well, that's one way to look at it. There's been a dramatic increase in the Hispanic population, about 75,000 additional people in the four-county Milwaukee metro area. And that's the same amount that the population overall has grown by since 2000. So you could look at it that without that growth, our regional population would have remained flat.
Well, right. So put that in context. What are the demographic shifts besides the Hispanic population here?
There has been some smaller growth in African American, Asian, and multiracial populations. And then there's been a big decline in the white population that, essentially the growth in some of those other communities has made up for. Like I said, if not for that growing Hispanic population, we wouldn't have grown at all.
So with that in mind, what were the gaps in what we knew about the Hispanic workforce that you sought to fill with the study?
Well, there's a lot of anecdotal knowledge about the types of occupations that Hispanics tend to be in, but we didn't know exactly how that would look if we looked at the numbers and what the wages were. We wanted to kind of look at the educational attainment and the trends in improving it, hopefully improving educational attainment. And then also we didn't really know what the younger pipeline looked like in terms of Hispanic kids who are graduating from high school in Milwaukee or going to college in Milwaukee. How are they doing and how do they compare to their peers?
Well, and so how were you able to crunch these numbers? Is this Census Bureau data you were working with?
The first piece of the report really does look mostly at census data and other federal data where we're looking at the overall adult population, the workforce, population changes, and then how Hispanics are distributed in the workforce and the wages for the different occupations that they're more or less concentrated in. Then we looked at MPS graduates, so Milwaukee Public Schools, both the traditional schools and the charter schools. We looked at the last 10 years of graduates to see what they've been doing in college as far as, what types of programs they've been going into and degrees they've been earning and how they compare to other students.
And does MPS have this kind of, is it longitudinal data?
So they participate in the National Student Clearinghouse, which tracks students across the country that go to any U.S. college or university. So it really is able to track almost every student And so, yeah, we looked at 10 years of their data. MPS helped us get that data through the National Student Clearinghouse.
Well, so let's go back then to the kinds of professions that Hispanics are filling in the Milwaukee area. And we should note, use the term Hispanics, partly, I'm guessing, because it was the Hispanic Professionals of Greater Milwaukee who commissioned the study, right?
Exactly. They're the ones who asked us to do this study. The term Hispanic, Latino, Latinx, there's different terms, I think, that are used that all kind of speak to the same population.
Well, and so then what did you find in terms of the kinds of occupations that that Hispanic workers fill in the Milwaukee area?
Yeah, so we found that Hispanic workers are much more concentrated in some of the fields that you do here that, you know, in terms of food preparation and serving, building and grounds, kinds of maintenance, cleaning occupations, but also production. Production was the number one industry. So those are the manufacturing and assembly types of jobs. Those are industries that Hispanics are more than double concentrated in relative to the general population. Then we also found occupations where Hispanics are very underrepresented, and those tend to be high-wage professional types of fields. So things like healthcare practitioners, so we're talking about physicians and nurses, legal profession, architecture, engineering, business and finance, management, those types of occupations.
And when you're talking about high wages, you're talking about essentially jobs that pay, what, $60,000 and above, right?
Right. So we actually saw that there was almost a reverse relationship between the occupations Hispanics are most concentrated in and those that pay the most. So they're sort of opposite distributions. But right. So when we looked at occupations that pay at least $60,000 or higher, Hispanics are very underrepresented in all of those. In many of them, they're less than half the concentration you would expect based on their size in the population. The only occupation that they were at least as represented in as the general population that paid at least $40,000 median annual salary was a construction.
Well, and presumably a lot of the high wage jobs require a certain level of education. And so that leads us to the next part of the study, which is the kinds of educational attainment you're seeing for the Hispanic population in the Milwaukee area.
Exactly. That was the key that, how do we fill or how do we close these disparities? And is the current trajectory of younger Hispanic population on track to kind of close those disparities and be more represented in those high-wage occupations?
Well, and so what did you find in terms of what kinds of educational levels the Hispanic population in Metro Milwaukee has?
We found sort of a mix. There are definitely some positive trends. There's been an increase in Hispanics with at least a high school diploma. There's been a double-digit increase percentage-wise since over 10 years. So that's been really positive. There's been an increase in college enrollment. There's been an increase in the percentage of Hispanics with a bachelor's degree or higher, but still big disparities between Hispanics and the overall population.
Right. This is a pipeline phenomenon, right? This is not something that can be remedied overnight.
Right. So it is. So we were partly wanting to see, well, is the pipeline at least looking, more like the Hispanic, more like the non-Hispanic or the general population, so that at least the gap would be closing over time. We found that we looked at these MPS graduates the last 10 years, and we found that a smaller percentage of Hispanic graduates have enrolled in college since graduating high school than in the other major racial groups. So that was a little bit discouraging. We did see, like I said, that enrollment has been going up, and they have been increasingly enrolling in college. But then another major difference that we saw when we looked at the graduates, the MPS graduates, was those who have gone on to complete college. The Hispanics are more likely to have completed a short certificate, sort of 1 year or shorter program at a technical college, and much less likely or to have completed a bachelor's or advanced degree than non-Hispanics.
Well, and so then at the end of the day here, this all speaks to a problem that does not look like it could be solved overnight.
Right. It just seems like it's currently looking like it'll be a long time to close these gaps unless things change and improvement starts to progress more quickly.
Right. It sounds like this is not just an issue of how much jobs pay. This is an issue of, getting a significant part of the population ready to fill those jobs.
Exactly. Yeah. And, the need to get further up into these bachelor's and advanced degrees, which is, not only are those occupations high paying, but they're also some of the fastest growing. We have fast-growing occupations that are low-wage, like food preparation and serving types of occupations that Hispanics are already overrepresented in. But we see quite a few of those that I mentioned, those management, business and finance, healthcare, legal, those are growing quickly in the metro area. And so there's a need to get more Hispanic students to get through those programs.
Joe Pietrangelo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. The group's study of wages among Hispanic workers in the Milwaukee area is called Upward Mobility, and it was released this morning. You'll find a link to more from WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now and then learn about how those mail-order clothes stylists are affecting the work of designers and merchandise managers. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Since she returned to her alma mater as an executive fellow, we've chatted with fashion designer Donna Rico periodically about the work she's doing with the next generation of designers. Rico graduated from Mount Mary College, now university, and went on to a successful career as a dress designer.
It's a big couple of weeks for the fashion students at Mount Mary who are taking part in the event called CREO, which is the annual showcase of work from students in creative fields, including fashion design, along with studio art, art therapy, and others. It culminates with a student designer fashion show next Friday. Donna Rico joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the program. And I will just start by saying, Donna Rico, welcome back to Lake Effect. It's great to see you again.
I'm really happy to be here.
So I want to start this interview with a really basic question, but it dawned on me as I was getting ready that I don't think we've ever actually answered it before. This is a big windup here and you're worried. What is the difference between fashion and style?
Well, first of all, Mitch, did you think long and hard about what you're going to wear today for this meeting?
I thought long and hard up to the point where I found what was clean.
Right.
Because that is how men get dressed.
Right. Well, people confuse the two, fashion and style. And really, I feel fashion is what we see coming down the runways, the trends of the season, what's being presented to us by the designers who are the pros and who have their message. And fashion changes constantly. And that's why we buy, because there's always something new. And that's what fashion is. Style is really how you wear fashion. It's how you put yourself together. And style doesn't just involve clothing. It involves your point of view, what you like to eat. Who are you? What is your personality? That's your style. So really, it's the way that an individual puts together the fashion for themselves. That's what style is.
I imagine in this business, you must see a lot of people confusing the two.
Well, maybe the words, fashion shows used to be called style shows, and it would bother me because it's not about the styling, it's about the fashion. What makes a show exciting is to see that newness and to see that designer point of view. And, style, it's like, there's a lot of different styles, but it's something that you have your whole life,
Right. So someone's sense of style is consistent or potentially consistent from year to year, but the fashion that plays into that style is what's evolving.
Right. And then sometimes you can get stuck in a style. They always say if you wore it once before, you shouldn't wear it again. You should, keep updated and always and keep up to date regarding fashion. But style is really, again, the way you put yourself together and the message that you're promoting about yourself. It's your identity.
Do fashion trends drive changes in style?
Well, certainly they do. Think about the 60s and bell-bottoms in the 70s. Okay, bell-bottom pants. Well, you know, those disappeared and we all started wearing stovepipe pants and jeans. And, you know, then we were wearing low-rise jeans and skinny legs. And now, you know, the flares are coming back. But really, the styles do change, you know, as the fashion changes. Skirt lengths is another example of that. You know, short skirts from the 60s became longer in the 70s, and now anything goes. So there really isn't any one appropriate style for the length of a skirt, for instance.
You have been back at Mount Mary for almost a year, coming up on a year, and I'm curious to have you reflect on how you see students today going about the work of getting into this field versus the way things were in your student days.
Well, you know, certainly a lot has changed, but the one thing that remains the same is that as a student, when I was a student, and for students today, they have to have an idea. They have to understand where are they going with their creativity. And I think that it makes a more confident designer or a grad, or in our program we have merchandise management as well, which is also a very creative field. But, you know, to say – for students – to understand how important it is to have an idea and a message before they can really be a successful creator. I always like to talk about or challenge students with who is your customer and where are they going? And it can really help define the work that a young designer is trying to accomplish.
Do you think we're able or you know, a young designer is able to identify their potential customer in more ways than we used to, you know, sort of given I guess the reality of everything today?
Of technology, yeah. And the fact that there's so much, students can see so much easier than I could. I mean, when I graduated, there were no computers, and I left for New York, and I did have a plan, though. I was 23, and I said, who am I designing for? And I could only design for people like myself. I didn't know it was New York. You know, there were designers that were making dresses for thousands of dollars. Well, I didn't have that experience. I stuck to my, you know, Midwestern values and made dresses for people like me. So I think that, you know, students today can – it's still an important message. And there's a lot of – there's always been competition. I had competition – students, graduates today, young designers have competition, but it's all right there in front of them. So I think it's harder for them because they're bombarded with so much information to focus. And I'm, you know, I always advise them, step away from the screen, you know, get out and go to a museum, look at what people are wearing. You know, that was always a big inspiration to me to see, what are people wearing on the streets of New York? I loved watching people on the street, and it helped inspire me and discover where I wanted to go with my design and my business.
You talked about how creativity manifests itself, and one of the things you just said a couple of minutes ago was the idea of merchandise management as a creative endeavor. Can you talk more about that? Because I don't think people necessarily imagine that as being the creative part of the business.
Well, it's very creative, and it's a good opportunity for our students who maybe don't have the ability to create something from nothing, whereas a merchandise management student, they not only learn the business of fashion and the planning and all of that, but it also they can become stylists. They're taking the product that's already been designed and putting it together in a way that works for either the retailer or for the customers themselves with subscription clothing services. It's a big opportunity for stylists these days to put together outfits for the customers.
Well, and I was going to ask about that because there are a lot of people who are buying their clothes sight unseen now.
Right.
How does that impact? I mean, you know, you're talking about like imagining, you know, the idea of dressing people that you see walking by. You could literally be doing that, and they could, you know, not know what they're about to get.
Well, you know, the beauty of having the internet and having direct marketing is that it's pretty irresistible. You're scrolling through your screen. You're on Instagram. You're on Facebook, and an ad pops up, and you see something. Oh, it's completely put together. You know, all I have to do is you know, tell them my size and press the button, and it'll be at my door. door. And it's such an easy way to dress. You know, I think it's pretty, like I said, it's irresistible. Some people still like to touch and feel the quality before they buy. And, you know, for those people, they can still go to the store. Some people combine both. You know, they look online, they see what they like, and then maybe they'll go to the store to feel it and check it out and try it on.
Of course, at some level, I mean, we were talking about the difference between fashion and style, and by doing these subscription services, we're kind of outsourcing our own sense of style.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I like about it is the reason I designed dresses was because I wasn't very good at putting things together for myself. I wasn't a sportswear customer. I didn't like the idea of having to, pick a top and a sweater or a jacket and a pair of pants or a skirt and then the shoes. And that's why I designed dresses, because it was head to toe. It was one thing and, you know, you put it on and you look good. I sort of compare it to these styling services and subscription clothing services today, because they put it all together for you. It's not a dress, but it is a head-to-toe look. And I think that's what people are looking for, the ease of looking, you know, on trend and to have it delivered to their door. It's pretty simple.
For sure. What do you think, what have you tried to bring to the table in these months that you have been working with the fashion program?
Well, I work on campus for a week every month, and it's a very busy week. I'm trying to become involved with students in class. I've been invited to presentations, and I love critiquing their work. I love seeing the students stand up and do their presentation, and you know, at the end, it's like, does anyone have any questions? And I have about a million of them, so I have to hold back. But I love, you know, talking to the students and working with them directly. One opportunity I had this past winter was to our students were invited to participate in the American Heart Association's Red Dress Collection, which is a fashion show that was held in March. And Faye Wetzel of Faye's was asked us to partner. She was involved, and she was having dresses from her store, and our students were to design, create, and design and make their own dresses. And so I looked at it as a way to access students in a way that I really haven't yet. And it was a great opportunity for me to see where their heads were at and how much they knew about creating and the process. So Ashley Brooks, the chairman of the department, and I created a design brief. And it required students really to follow the steps that we used in industry to create and make a garment. And that meant that there were, you know, strict guidelines. There were strict steps that they had to take. They had to do all the work outside of class, and most of it was done over winter break because they weren't in class for a number of weeks, and it made it a little easier. But every time I came to campus, I would meet with these 10 or so students that were competing, and the first step was to show their sketch ideas, and I didn't want to just see one sketch. I wanted to see at least 10 sketches, and then I wanted them to tell me, you know, what's the message, and who's the customer, and what are you trying to convey, and now what's your ability, and which of these styles do you feel confident that you can actually make into the final dress? And then there were fabric selection, and they would show the fabrics, and then construction details and patterning details, and we would advise them through every step. We did a first fitting was in the muslin fabric, which is fitting the pattern to make sure it fit, and then we did a final fitting in the actual fabric about 2 weeks before the event.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's setting a culture of high expectations, like they're gonna run into in the industry.
And that's where I come in. I love working with them and challenging them, and hopefully inspiring them to think a little deeper, a little outside of the box. And that's really one of my goals in coming back to Mount Mary, is to be able to affect students and enlighten them in ways that they may not be aware of. You know, they learn the tools and the skills at school, and they learn the history of fashion, and the merchandise managers learn to be creative in ways other than, you know, making something. But so it's been really rewarding in that respect.
And in a lot of ways, we are just coming up on what is probably the busiest time of the year for the department.
Yes, we're planning. Students are making their final garments, and we're planning our Creo Fashion Show, which happens on May 10th. And it's really a great event. It's a showcase not only for our designers who show their garments, but for our merchandise management students who create in the way that they create. They plan the the theme and the choreography, and they pick the music and the whole feel of the show. They organize it into they have a show schedule, and they take the garments and merchandise them into the final show. It's really great. My perspective and that part has been really great. And I've also loved meeting so many people in the community, shop owners and people involved in fashion initiatives and fashion incubators and just people that have a love for Mount Mary and like to stay informed and involved. And that's been really rewarding for me as well.
To give you a sense of optimism about the field?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, fashion, it's not going away. it's transitioning, and people may think, oh, the business is in trouble, stores are closing. Well, the stores that are closing are the ones that haven't been innovative in planning their next move or ignoring the reality of direct marketing online and how they can, you know, there really is a way to have both as a retailer. So I think there's plenty of opportunities for young fashion students or for any fashion students. And, you know, the future is bright for fashion. We'll always wear clothes.
One hopes, anyway.
Well.
Donna Rico, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Fashion designer Donna Rico is an executive fellow at Mount Mary University, her alma mater. You can find a link to more about the school's annual Creo Showcase and student designer fashion show from WUWM.com.
Radio Chipstone focuses attention on so-called functional fashions when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Between 1955 and 1976, nearly 30 of the United States' top clothing designers created garments to fit disabled bodies, called the Functional Fashions Line. It remains the largest collaborative effort to design clothing by, with, and for disabled persons in American history.
From high-end sportswear to everyday labels, designer Helen Cookman, whose own disability was hearing loss, led the charge. Cookman co-authored Functional Fashions for the Physically Handicapped and developed a sample collection along with then-New York Times style editor Virginia Pope.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Natalie Wright of the Chipstone Foundation tells contributor Jennifer Fields to pay close attention to the language used to talk about disabled bodies. The first garment in the exhibit also serves to broaden the definition of functional.
Bonnie Cashin designed this piece in 1957. It was first published in Harper's Bazaar in 1957. Bonnie Cashin is really one of the pioneers of American sportswear design. And it's this really spectacular orange and purple mohair with hints of green. And what makes it really special is that it has the kind of classic Bonnie Cashin hardware on it, where she's put these clips along the waistband of the skirt that allows the user to very quickly hitch up the front of the skirt and attach sort of the middle of the skirt up to the waistband. So she really designed this for a very specific purpose, which was to allow herself and other women to walk upstairs with items occupying their hands, so they wouldn't have to set items down and lift up their skirt as they're walking upstairs. So Bonnie Cashin was really interested in creating high-style designs that would also be unrestrictive for the modern mobile woman. It's really an amazing design that holds up, like all of Bonnie Cashin's pieces, at any point in time.
I'm glad that this is a piece we started off with, because it forces me, it invites me to broaden my consideration of what it means to be a piece of fashion that is also functional.
Yeah, and basically this item was republished by Functional Fashions in the early 1960s, around 1963, as a really sophisticated design for women with limited mobility. This item really helps us to tell the story of the items that were a part of the Functional Fashions line that weren't necessarily designed for disabled bodies, but that Helen Cookman and other people who were helping to run the Functional Fashions line saw as really great solutions anyways, even though they may not have been designed expressly for that purpose.
But this is one that I would call a Mary Tyler Moore dress. It's very much like Mary Tyler Moore going to work with her little hat on.
Exactly. And so with the Bonnie Cashin piece, this sort of designed, you know, in the 50s, the piece that we're looking at right now is designed by Vera Maxwell in the 70s, right around the time that Helen Cookman and other folks who are running the functional fashions line pass away. So it's really, it's sort of the end of the functional fashions line. And Vera Maxwell, again, was really interested in mobility and speed. And this is actually, this item is actually called a speed suit. And what's really interesting is that Vera Maxwell says it's perfect for the woman who wants to dress quickly or, quote unquote, anyone whose fingers are crippled with arthritis. This dress doesn't have any fastenings on it at all. It's designed with a knit lycra. You can slip it on over your head and take it off, so there are no buttons or anything like that.
But it also has those elegant points to it. You would never know if you were just looking at this dress. It looks like two pieces until you get close and you realize that it's one. Everything is constructed together.
Mm-hmm. And you'll find also that a lot of these items have pockets. Both the Bonnie Cashin piece and the Vera Maxwell piece have pockets, which even is something that's celebrated in women's wear today. There was a lot of emphasis on utility and functionality for women's bodies and mobility in general that that coincided with this movement for disability design.
And I was also, Natalie, really surprised to find that even Levi's was in the functional fashion game for a while.
Yeah, there were nearly 30 designers who were creating clothing with and for disabled bodies. So it's the largest collaborative effort to create clothing for disabled persons in American history. And it really hasn't been recognized as much in the historical record. And we're so lucky to have this piece, the Levi's Letter publication from 1975, loaned to us from the Levi Strauss & Co. archives. It's this fantastic piece that shows how Helen Cookman's patented trousers for a handicapped person, this patented design from 1960, is then adapted for Levi's jeans in 1975. So it has her design solutions, which are zippers that go down the sides of each leg, and then also a belt that allows either the front or the back of the jeans to drop down for ease of movement and getting the pants on and off, using the bathroom, any of our daily activities that we do with jeans to help users with disabilities.
Natalie, what were the series of events that caused people to understand the need for a functional fashions line?
One of the introductory pieces in this functional fashions display is an Eames splint. This item was really created to help stabilize and transport wounded soldiers in World War II. And what we find is that this individual named Dr. Howard Rusk is working with wounded soldiers who would have been using something like the Eames splint to recover from their injuries. And he's really one of the founders of rehabilitation. And so after World War II, he goes to the Institute of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at New York University. And he's really trying to work with not only soldiers, but then civilians in the United States on this field of rehabilitation. And so then he brings in the designer Helen Cookman to think through clothing solutions for disabled users. And what's so interesting about this moment in time is that this is happening alongside other types of design, so home design as well as lots of other items. So another book that we have on display, which was written by Dr. Howard Rusk and Eugene Taylor, it shows a lot of the other design solutions that were being created at the Institute of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, which were often kind of pioneered by patients at the Institute. So there was a lot of motivation within this time of kind of a do-it-yourself mentality, where part of the therapies that they were putting forward for patients there was to encourage them to find solutions to barriers that they were finding in a non-disabled built environment, essentially.
So now what is this? This book reminds me of, how can I say that? It's that really clear, almost, not Better Homes and Gardens. It is Better Homes and Gardens, 1950-something. This is how you should keep your house clean, and this is what you should do, and this is the hat you should wear with this dress. So Natalie, walk me through this piece.
So this is a book that Helen Cookman wrote with occupational therapist Muriel Zimmerman during her 5 years at the Institute of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, and it is called Functional Fashions for the Physically Handicapped. It was published in 1961, and one of my favorite things about it is really the length of it. We have the actual book on display, but also a digitized version of it, and what we're really hoping for is that visitors will flip through and see just how dense it is and the extent to which they thought through every single aspect of the designs that they were creating for disabled users, both aesthetically. That was a sort of a base point, that the designs had to be beautiful.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
We will take one last break, and then the smooth sounds of Milwaukee's own Al Jarreau fill the studio. We'll be back right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie Norris.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Of the many world-class musicians that have come out of Milwaukee, Al Jarreau is among the finest. Over the course of his career, the multifaceted singer and composer, known as the Acrobat of Scat, had 34 singles on the charts. He was nominated for 19 Grammys and won 7. From his early days in jazz through his soul and pop hits of the 80s to his return to jazz towards the end of his life, Jarreau's music was the soundtrack for a lot of people.
Saturday evening at the Granville Connection on Brown Deer Road, a group of Milwaukee area musicians will come together to pay tribute to Jarreau. 2 years in the making, the My Old Friend tribute band is the brainchild of trumpeter and middle school music teacher Jeff Kitzman. He and 9 of the 12 band members recently took over Lake Effect's performance studio, the hallway outside it, and the conference room across from it to perform a couple of Jarreau's tunes, the Moonlighting theme and We're in This Love Together. Jeff, along with guitarist Jay Craggs, singer Kimberly Johnson, and bassist Ethan Bender, joined us in the small studio to talk about Jarreau and his legacy. Thank you for being here. I know this is only 4 of the how many, Jeff?
I think there's 12 all together.
All together in My Old Friend.
Yeah.
So talk about this band. Why did you want to start this?
This was when Al Jarreau passed away a couple years. I'd always loved his music, but I thought, you know, Al being from Milwaukee, that we just really needed to pay tribute to him and his music, because I know for me, and I think for everybody else in this group, it's just been kind of a undercurrent almost my whole musical life, listening to his music. So
it was so richly orchestrated. You know, he had a wonderful way with melody, but there's a lot of layers in what he did.
Yeah. Just the harmonies and his vocal scats, and he just so talented.
Kimberly, do you remember the first time you heard him? How old were you?
Wow. I don't remember how old I was, but I remember when Moonlighting came out, the show. I loved that show. I was in love with Bruce Willis at the time. And I would always sing that song. I just loved it. And then Morning came out, and I loved the video, the little cartoon. So I was rather young, but I loved him. And being a part of this project, I've heard songs that I never heard before. And it was fascinating. And I have a newfound respect for him. I always loved him. But oh my goodness, just listening to some of the things he did, amazing, amazing.
I think a lot of us who aren't musicians don't realize that he was also a great composer, too. I mean, it wasn't just that he was a great singer and musician. You know, he also wrote a ton of stuff that you might not attribute to him.
Right. Yeah, he wrote amazingly a lot of music. He covered a lot of music amazingly, but he worked with a lot of really incredible writers and producers, and they just turned out some amazing stuff.
Is there something particularly Milwaukee about his sound, do you think?
I don't know. What do you think, Ethan?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah.
I do know that he came up at a time in Milwaukee, particularly in the black community, where there are a lot of jazz greats that came out of that, his generation, Bunky Green, I'm sure he probably was around Frank Morgan and others, Manti Ellis. So I'm sure that had a lot to do with shaping his sound, his perspective, you know, where he came from.
Yeah, we tend to think of Chicago as having all of the jazz stuff going on, but Milwaukee really had
a lot of good stuff happening here
and still does.
Yep.
Absolutely. Pulling this project together, Jeff, what were you trying to do? I mean, is this something, I know you're doing a tribute. There's going to be like a fundraiser thing going on.
Yeah, we're doing a show.
But is there something beyond that?
We'd all like there to be something beyond this. I mean, we're doing this for this upcoming show, but I think we all have a vision that it could be a lot more, and it's something that we could continue and keep his music alive, and for us, just being able to keep playing his music. When I started, it was just like I said, I wanted to do tribute to Al and just play his music, and then I just, you know, talk about like the Olympic basketball team. You want your dream team. I got my dream team. I found the people that I absolutely wanted to do this with, some who I've known for 30 years and some who I've only known for, you know, maybe the last 10, 15 or even a couple. But these are the people I wanted to make this music with.
So, Jay, are you one of the 30 years?
Yeah, I think so. Jeff and I have been through a lot together.
So from a guitar perspective, what does this music offer you?
Well, like Ethan said, that depending on what era of Al's music you listen to, there's a lot of things from the Milwaukee, that song, that album, up through the Los Angeles stuff. One of my heroes was Jay Graydon, who produced tons of hits and great guitar player and all kinds of different studio projects. I had met him a couple times just when I was working in L.A. and stuff, and I don't know him well, but I knew him enough to I just reached out to him. And he was very kind. This was soon after Al died, and he hooked me up with Larry Williams. And they helped us out with forwarding some charts and stuff. And I think he liked the idea that we were doing a benefit. We're doing it for the Music Educators Association in Madison and that kind of thing. So they were all kind of behind, at least giving us a little bit of a helping hand as well. So, but it was very cool to see some of the original charts. And like I said, Jay's was one of my major influences when I was growing up. Even now, I mean, just a ridiculous guitar player.
So, Ethan, how did you connect with Jeff?
That's a good question. Networking and
Milwaukee. And
had you played in other bands before?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You had to have a good bass player.
Always.
Yeah. Always have a good bass player.
Yes.
And what about Kimberly? How did you guys connect?
A friend of mine, who I perform with on occasion, performed with Jeff, and he brought my name up, and I got a phone call from Jeff, and that was the history.
Yeah, and you actually get to sing your favorite song.
Yes.
Yeah, which is terrific.
When you meet along the way.
And I have to say, for the listening audience, we normally do everything in Studio C, which is our performance studio, but we're only able to get four of the – how many of you were here tonight?
We had nine here tonight.
Nine here tonight, which is not the entire group.
Right.
But we used the hallway and we used the conference room as the vocal booth. And that's probably the first time I think that we've spread out that far. But it sounds fantastic.
Thank you. It absolutely
sounds fantastic. Thinking about his music, to me, he always epitomized – just that smoothness. There was just this wonderful, rich, smooth, creamy quality to his music. Was he always like that, or did he have more of a jazz thing happening earlier in his career?
I think earlier on in his career, when he was still in Milwaukee, started as more of a jazz thing and still did that when he got out to L.A., but then, you know, with like the Giro album, he started to cross over into more of the pop side of things with Giro and High Crime and Ella's for Lover, some of those albums. But in his later years, he went back to doing a lot more of the jazz kind of stuff.
It's like a diamond ring, it's a precious thing. And we never wanna lose it. It's like your favorite song that we love to sing. Every time we hear the music, we're in this love together. We got the kind that lasts forever. Together, it's like there is on a vine. It gets sweeter all the time. It's like a rainy night in candlelight. So romantic. We got the whole thing working out so right. And it's just the way we planned it. We're in this love together. We got the kind that'll last forever. It's like there is on a vine. It gets sweeter all the time.
Very quickly, favorite Al Jarreau song, Jay?
I'll Be Here for You.
Probably, man, this, the horn writing on it is also amazing as a trumpet player. It's really hard, but I probably have to say Black and Blues.
Ethan?
You stole my song, Jay.
Oh,
I'm trying to think of one. No, do not retract. From that, no, it wasn't from the same album. Falling, was that High Crime? It was an album cut. It wasn't a single that was released. It was a ballad called Falling. But it was in that time period, yeah.
Okay.
Like Jarreau and High Crime.
After working with these guys and listening to these songs, I'm starting to fall in love with Roof Garden. Okay. I was driving up here, and I sang that for about 20 minutes. And it's not even a song that I sing. So I really enjoyed the sound he made with that. It was all that bonk, 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 bonk. You know, I love that. He's just amazing. And even when I would see some interviews with him in the past, I got some great tips from him and tips that I use now.
Like what?
Like, what he did was is he waited until the end of a phrase to add some vibrato. And usually a lot of people have their vibrato on this all the time, like Elmer Fudd, and you can't sound like that on a song. And so I tend to make a conscious effort to try to leave the vibrato for the end of the phrase because of him.
So it's smooth tone until that very end.
Until that end, and you just put that little icing on the cake.
Oh, fun.
Nice. Yes, I got that from him.
Did you pick up anything musically from him in terms of phrasing or thinking about music?
Not really. More, it was for me, it was more of a, and I hate to say this because of my parents' generation, they're gonna want to come at me after this, but it was more for me, he was kind of the soundtrack of my life. If you went back to, you know, late 70s, early 80s, like the same time period we're talking about, you know, High Crime, Ellis for Lover, all that stuff, that was, that's what was popular, like you said, and that's what I heard.
My Old Friend, a tribute to Al Jarreau, is Jeff Kitzman, Jamie Beckman, and Guy Kammer on trumpet, Taras Nahirniak on keyboards, Ethan Bender on bass, Brian Dale on drums, Jay Craggs on guitar, and singers Kimberly Johnson and Joe Jordan.
The band plays this Saturday evening at Granville Connection on Brown Deer Road, and there is more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air is next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.
Does anyone want to go waltzing in the garden? Does anyone want to go dance up on the roof? Does anyone want to go waltzing in the garden?